And now, the Dave Kinchin Show.
By the time you hear this, the city of Philadelphia will have reached 500 homicides so far for 2021. This is unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this. Last year, 499 homicides to finish the year of 2020. That was a 30-year high. But now, 500 homicides, and the year's not even over yet. I can see the car in my mind, this car that belonged to Jessica Covington, a 32-year-old woman who was 7 months pregnant. She was shot and killed right outside of her house. She was unloading gifts from her baby shower. This was on Saturday night, so just a few nights ago, if you're tuning in, depending on when you're tuning into this podcast. We knew the call was bad. We heard a report first on the scanner, then confirmed that a pregnant woman was shot. It's bad when anybody is shot, but especially a pregnant woman. Now, I mention this car because it's the image that stays in my mind of such tragedy and evil, and we're going to walk into all of this as we discuss gun violence in the city of Philadelphia, what many major cities are dealing with, how cities are responding, how families are transformed forever. But trying to answer the question, where do we go from here? I can certainly tell you where we've been. And I can tell you where I've been on this as a journalist covering this for 10 years in the city of Philadelphia, but really almost 20 years in many places, including Saginaw, Michigan, Flint, Michigan, Lansing, Michigan, Camden, New Jersey, Trenton, New Jersey. And some of the bigger stories of gun violence that I've covered around the country, too. We'll get into all of that. We'll unpack all of that. And especially the role that I had in government looking at these issues in terms of, from a communications standpoint, looking at the programs and the policies in place to try to knock this violence down and look at how we were getting the word out, but also some reflections on what I saw. Nothing political, no political commentary here, but just trying to give you an idea of what it's like inside, in this case, Philadelphia City Hall, but what it's like inside the city halls of many major cities across the country, because we did have many conversations with other cities, big cities, throughout all of the, my time in government. As they were trying to figure out how the hell do we stop this violence. But I want to go back to this car belonging to or driven by Jessica Covington. Before we wrapped up our reporting that night, the cabin light was on in the car. And it was right outside her house, parked in a way where you're unloading things. There were all these gifts from her baby shower. She just got home from her baby shower. She took her, according to police and friends, took her mom home too. Got her mom in the house and was unloading gifts when someone came up and shot her 11 times, shot her in the head and stomach. First responders tried everything they could to save her, but they could not save her. They could not save her unborn child. I've covered a lot of stories. You know, if you become a journalist in a big city, and anywhere really, you're going to cover violence, you're going to cover gun violence. But this story impacted me. This is probably up there. It's in the top 10 of the worst, and they're all bad. Please don't misunderstand. Any act of gun violence is bad, okay, and horrible, but this one hit me in a way where it's got to be probably, it's in the top 10 of the worst stories I've covered, and that includes covering aspects of the Pulse nightclub mass shooting and the Vegas mass shooting 4 years ago in October of 2017. It struck me because the highest of the high in terms of happiness. Talking with Jessica Covington's friends, they bought her gifts. You know, they laughed. Teresa, one of her friends, said, "We laughed, we cried. It was a joyous time." And they loaded the gifts in her car at the end of the party. And then they get the call sometime later that she was killed. I was there that night when a woman ran up and said, "She's my best friend." It's some of the most horrific, one of the most horrific things that I've seen and heard on a story. And it's been a while. It was a while since I ran into something so dramatic. So it took me a minute. It took me aback. Because it had been a while, you know. Generally, you see the scene, and I've seen the dead bodies in the street. I've seen the shell casings on the ground. But you don't always, often the family's been there or they're on their way. But a woman who said she was Miss Covington's best friend came up and said, "We just had a baby shower. What happened? What happened?" And hearing it was just horrific. And the police walked her back a bit from the scene and tried to calm her down. And at some point they had to tell her what had happened. But I left that night feeling incredibly deflated because I can't imagine this joyous celebration, a new life on the way, and a mother, a soon to be mother, or a mother to be, however you want to say it. And then in an instant, it goes the other way, completely opposite, like the most dramatic other way it can go. Unborn baby and mother are dead. At that point, Saturday night, the latest victims of Philadelphia's gun violence crisis, and really America's gun violence crisis. I struggled to think how that car could sit there with those gifts that were meant for the mother to be and her baby to be. And now it's a crime scene and it's evidence. Just like that, in the blink of an eye. And then, really, a day before that, a woman named Takiyah Patton, 24 years old, was shot and killed while walking her twin 5-year-old boys through their neighborhood, according to police, shot by her ex-boyfriend, who's now facing charges and was arrested. I mean, walking with your twin boys and you're shot and killed in your own community. Now, according to Philadelphia police, what they told us, this meant that as of Monday night of this week, 64 women have been shot and killed in Philadelphia for 2021 so far, and 500 homicides. You know, I've got notes here, but it's really hard to sort through where I want to begin. Because the personal impact is, I mean, I cried. It's been a long time since I've cried. Walter Cronkite once said, you know, he's the journalist we've all sort of aspired to and certainly have a long, long, long way to go, but he said, I read it at one time, I think it was a book or something where he was quoted. He said, journalists have this ability to separate our emotions from a story. And I believe that to mean in a healthy way so that we can tell the story, so that we can do our jobs effectively. But I've always been sort of tortured by that because I felt like you can't lose that human factor. You know, that has to be there as you, yes, tell the story objectively, but it has to be there. And for me, it came full bore Saturday night. I mean, I was just a subdued feeling, a defeated, deflated feeling as we went back to the television station, because I did not understand how that kind of evil could exist. And there's all kinds of speculation. I'm not even going to get into the speculation, you know. The police did say that Miss Covington was apparently targeted. It certainly sounds like that according to the situation. Many people, it leads them to go one way or another in terms of a whodunit. But regardless of the circumstances that led up to it, which is all under investigation and police are questioning a suspect at last check, and they're putting a lot of resources on this. This is a national story. This story has been everywhere. Coming back from your own baby shower and murdered in cold blood. You know, one of the comments that somebody wrote on a tweet when I reported what I knew from the scene, somebody tweeted, they said, "Who are some of these people that we share this world with?" And I thought that was very profound. I mean, who are some of these people, you know, in terms of people capable of committing such unspeakable atrocities? And that's what this was. There's been an increase in domestics. Experts have certainly said the pandemic has had a lot to do with that. Job losses, overall tension. Tensions are even higher now. The pandemic is and has certainly been attributed to part of the cause of this spike in violence that every major American city darn near has started seeing last year. In the pandemic year into now. But there's a level of evil that even I never thought could exist. Pointing a gun at a woman's stomach, knowing she's pregnant, 7 months pregnant, it's obvious. For anyone who's 7 months pregnant, right? You point a gun and you fire. I'm furious thinking about it. I'm emotional thinking about it. And Miss Covington's mother, who now is without a daughter and without a soon-to-be grandchild. And just that car sitting there with the remaining gifts inside and the cabin light on, almost just eerie, just an incredibly eerie, sad, anger-inducing sight. I covered the funeral for the youngest shooting victim in the Pulse nightclub attack, Akira Murray. She had just graduated from college, and she went down with some friends, including someone who we interviewed on this program, Patience Carter, who was an intern at my TV station. When the Pulse nightclub attack happened, I didn't know at the time that there'd be this local connection, you know, that one of our interns would be shot in the leg. Thankfully, she survived. We talked with her about it on this program, when we relaunched it 2 years ago, and you can go back and listen to that interview, but, I think as we were trying to work our way through, how do we do this podcasting thing? So it was during the infancy of us getting into the podcasting world. But I saw Patience collapse, you know, at the funeral for Miss Murray, who was dressed in her graduation gown, as I recall, in the coffin or casket, however you want to say. I remember there were family members who broke down and collapsed and couldn't even get into the church. And the family was gracious enough to let us cover it. We were in the back, the press, we were in the back. We were obviously keeping our distance. But Patience, who survived, you know, was on crutches and collapsed as she approached the coffin. And I had the same feeling there that I had looking at that car that Jessica Covington left behind. I thought the highest of joy, you know, they went down to celebrate. Akira Murray had a full ride scholarship, as I remember, to a university to play basketball. She was an outstanding student. She was an outstanding athlete. She celebrated her hard work on a vacation, you know? And a few days later, she's lifeless, embalmed in a box wearing that graduation outfit. It was ghastly. Just as it was when they sent me out to Las Vegas for the country concert where Stephen Paddock opened fire from the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Resort, killing scores of people, the worst mass shooting in American history. I talked to a doctor at a hospital who said they had to triage people. He said the floor of that hospital, so many people came, they called doctors in from all over the place. This was a hospital that had the most victims that came to one particular medical center. They came in, the victims were thrown into the backs of trucks, into cars, and they had to triage people. And they put, and I want to say there were three color ribbons on, I think it was on their toes, green for people who may be likely to make it, yellow for people who may not be likely to make it, who are not likely to make it, and I think it was red for people who did not have a chance of survival. So this is part of their triage process. This is from memory here, but it's vivid, all right? And what really got me is this doctor who said that the cleaning crew would come by and have the floor was like a river of blood. It was covered with blood, and they'd come by and clean, and then there was just more blood on the floor, like no one even came by to clean it. In a flash, all these people who went to a country concert, you know, listen to great music, and they were gone. So what I'm trying to say is I've seen this at so many levels. And I still struggle to explain. I mean, I can explain what I see based on eyewitness accounts, what I see. And I, you know, it's not like I've seen the act happen, don't get me wrong. It's more of the aftermath, immediate or semi-immediate aftermath. But I can't imagine, I can never imagine what the first responders see. And, you know, coming back to Philadelphia, I remember there was a story last year. While we were in the middle of the pandemic, there was a man who shot and killed his whole family. And one of the deputy commissioners who I worked with said even the officers were just completely emotional. They've never seen anything like that. So you have seasoned first responders, seasoned officers who have never seen this kind of stuff. Well, as bad as they end up seeing it in some of these cases. And, you know, the question is, what in the hell do we do to stop it all? Well, gun violence has always been there. And it was increasing here in Philadelphia before the pandemic, but the pandemic came along and the containment policies, the stay-at-home orders, the jobs that were closed, you know, Philadelphia being the biggest poor city in America, you know, the experts, there were university folks who looked at this and said, in fact, it was Temple University and I want to say Columbia because I was involved with the city of Philadelphia, the administration writing a statement responding to it. But this is one of those studies that kind of confirms what you know, that clearly the stress of the pandemic, the stress of the shutdown of businesses where people could not work, and it's already the biggest poor city in America, you know, and people can't work, and all of that certainly contributed to the violence that we've seen. And that gets into the part of the conversation, which really we can do a lot of shows on, talking about what is being done with all of this. And so we know that the pandemic certainly had a role, and that's by no means an excuse, and no one's using that as an excuse. City officials will point to the influx, the large flow of illegal guns into the city. They're working with the ATF to track these guns. I was in meetings when I was in the government to build connections with the ATF and find out more about where these guns are coming from, to take on the straw purchases. And I'll walk through all of that because I think it's interesting. I certainly learned a lot in terms of what's being done at the police level, but not just police, but other agencies. Like where I was in an office called the Office of Violence Prevention in October of 2019, and this was after a really bad violent weekend there, especially with, at that point, I think 100 kids that had been shot in the city of Philadelphia. I covered an infant who was driving with his mother, and someone shot into the car, and he was instantly, doctors said he instantly became a quadriplegic, barely survived. But then the next day, there was a young girl, 2-year-old girl, Nicolette Rivera, who was in her mother's arms. And as someone fired into the house, and as it was explained in a meeting, my first day on the job, as the communications manager for the Office of Violence Prevention. So that would have been like, say, a day after it happened. It happened, I want to say, on a Sunday. That Monday is my first day on the job. We go to the roundhouse, what we call it, police headquarters. And we, you know, I had been there for press conferences as a reporter. In fact, some of the press were there. They thought I was still with, they didn't know I left. But we went upstairs into the commissioner's office. I had never been in the police commissioner's office before. Some of the commanders in there were looking at me like, how did the press get in here? And my boss, Theron, had to say, no, he's with us. He's with the city now. But acting commissioner Christine Coulter came in, and then the mayor, we all stood up as the mayor came in, and the homicide captain gave all the details about what happened, how Nicolette was in her mother's arms when a bullet basically made her head explode, and there was blood and brain matter all over the place, including the ceiling. And that was a bit more than I was ready to take in at the moment. And I knew that I saw how we had to, you know, we determined the speaking order, you know, when the mayor was going to speak, when the managing director was going to speak, when the police commissioner would speak, when, you know, when the homicide captain would answer the questions, what happened, you know, of kind of blow by blow, what they knew about the case and everything. I had never seen anything like this before. So things were happening very quickly. But I knew that there was a sense of urgency in that moment that pardon the call there, put that on mute. But I knew in that moment that, and this was before the pandemic, that this was not only the administration's and the city's number one priority, but I was going to do my best to find out everything about all the programs the city's doing, and certainly get the word out about these programs while learning about them myself. And you know, we worked tirelessly to keep the community informed while dealing with the immense personal trauma of all of this happening at the same time. You know, what really got me was how personal every elected and appointed official took this. It was something that, I mean, I saw the mayor, his face flushed with emotion, and so many of the senior leadership, and I felt it too on cases like that with Nicolette Rivera and so many others. So now we get to the part, what are they doing? What are they doing to stop all of this? The city, right? Well, I can give you a perspective, having worked on this for almost 2 years, for the city of Philadelphia. Now, I worked on more of the communications aspect of it, and communications is certainly an aspect of getting the word out what's happening on the ground, but also a chance to learn about this. And I feel like now, being back in journalism, I have a better understanding of these issues. I mean, certainly I understood the personal angle and the policing and criminal justice, you know, basic side of it, you know, all of the basic dynamics that went into it. But having worked on it, I have a much deeper understanding of the internal dynamics of it. So I still have to go back to 2018 when I was in the press and we got word that the city was putting together a plan. So, you know, after every homicide, every murder that I covered or shooting, you know, we would mention the city recently announced they have a plan they're going to announce that they're going to put out there to tell the folks, tell the community is plural, it's a city of neighborhoods, how they're going to work on this issue and work to reduce violence in an unprecedented fashion. In other words, they had a plan that would be the farthest reaching, is what we were told, in terms of bringing together all of these agencies in government and getting them on the same page while bringing the community in as part of it. So in January of 2019, I went to City Hall. I was assigned to cover this. It was a press conference. And they announced something called the Philadelphia Roadmap to Safer Communities. The Philadelphia Roadmap to Safer Communities, or the Roadmap for short. And this was an idea, a plan that brought all of these, you know, you have police that will obviously be a part of this. You have, there was a relationship with the courts. There was a relationship with probation, certainly. But because they were treating gun violence as a health issue or a public health crisis, looking at it through the lens of public health, they brought in the health department. They brought in the Department of Intellectual, DBHIDS, the Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. And there was a major role for the community to play too. But the whole idea was creating, and I would see a lot more of this when I was in the government, but creating a series of programs that invested in the community that dealt with a lot of the indicators of violence, the causes of it, poverty, lack of resources relating to education, job training, but conflict resolution too, and getting people, getting boots on the ground to help police figure out these crimes and to quash beefs before they start. So the plan was housed largely, was run largely out of the Office of Violence Prevention. And it was overseen by an executive team that coordinated criminal justice and public safety anyway. So in Philadelphia, you have the managing director's office, which is, I like to call it the engine room of government, because so the mayor paints the vision, the mayor's staff makes sure that the mayor's vision is being carried out by various agencies. And then this is a very simplistic explainer of this, but just for the sake of time. But the managing director is the one government appointee who actually runs the city. kind of like a city manager in smaller towns where the mayor is, although the mayoral position is more ceremonial, the mayor and council, they hire a city manager, but the city manager is the chief executive of the city. Now, the mayor is a strong mayor. The mayor obviously is involved in running the city, of course, but the managing director runs the day-to-day affairs of the government. The day that makes sure that all of the city services are running properly, and there's divisions, there's a infrastructure, folks who handle infrastructure, there's folks who handle transportation, there's folks in my division, criminal justice and public safety. This was the division I would go into. It looked at everything from those agencies that work on violence prevention from a community aspect, also offices like the like emergency management, the Office of Criminal Justice, Town Watch, Integrated Services, licenses and inspection. They were all under this one umbrella. And so it seemed like a good place for the roadmap to be centered as well, although everyone looked towards the Office of Violence Prevention, which was in this criminal justice and public safety cluster, to put it all together. The senior director for violence prevention programs and strategies was in the Office of Violence Prevention, essentially ran the Office of Violence Prevention, and although there was also an executive director too, and he led the committee that known as a tactical committee that oversaw all of the major agencies that were a part of the roadmap. I know there's you need a chart for this. I know you're going to need a chart for all of this, but do your best to keep up. We'll get through it together. So anyway, we broke down the plan and started reporting on the plan. But then towards the summer, I got word that they were looking for a communications person. And so, you know, I had an interest in this, and I said, okay, well, let me get involved in this, or let me throw an application in and see, because I have a background in government before that, and I wanted to see where this could go. And I was fortunate enough to do some interviews and join the Office of Violence Prevention. And the whole idea was they had this plan, the roadmap. They wanted to build a communications structure around it and have someone who can implement communications activities to support the roadmap. Originally, they were going to try to do a whole campaign, kind of like in New Orleans. They had something called NOLA for Life, an idea of letting people know there are solutions that are based in evidence, but there's also a spirit of change coming that brings community together to create safer communities. We worked on that part of it, had a proposal, but because of COVID, by the time COVID came along, government was drastically reduced in terms of and restructured in terms of what was going to operate and what wasn't. So the administration pulled that plan at that time. But I came in and I learned of several programs that I would be involved in communicating to the community, to the media as well. We had the Community Crisis Intervention Program, which I actually just spoke with as I mentioned earlier, the person who provides that, his office, the Philadelphia Anti-Drug, Anti-Violence Network. I always get had to double check that. I always get the initials right, PAN, but Philadelphia Anti-Drug, Anti-Violence Network. Yeah, great group over there. And what they do is they provide staffing to the city under a contract for what's known as the Community Crisis Intervention Program. Now, these are workers. These are folks who have what they call lived experience. And so these are people who have lived the life of violence. They got busted for shooting someone or maybe it's thefts that they committed or something. But anyway, they were in the streets. They were involved in that life of crime, and they've turned their lives around. And as part of a way of doing that, they've maintained that they have a level of street cred, if you will, credibility in the streets. And they can be, we call them credible messengers, people who can reach the folks who are still in that life and let them know there's another way and try to mediate these conflicts before they you know, descend into shootings. And, you know, some police captains, because they would work with police districts and help get them information that that people may not be willing to provide police on their own. There were police captains across various parts of the city, a little bit in the western sections of the city, for example, and the northern parts of North Philadelphia, who would credit that program for helping to solve crimes, you know, and helping to get, at least for a while, a reduction in shootings in some areas. And this was tracked by something called Operation Pinpoint, which was part of the roadmap plan. It was a police strategy. It was a data-driven strategy. They still use it. So if you're familiar with something like ComStat, which is, you know, major city police departments use a data-driven approach to look at crimes, look at trends, and see where they need to put their resources to drive down certain, you know, as much violent crime as they can, as much crime as they can. So they look at robbery patterns, they look at all these things, they crunch the numbers, and they see, okay, where do we need to put the resources? Well, they're doing the same thing with this, with Operation Pinpoint, but they're, and it was in the ComStat room, we would meet in the police department. But what they would do is look at what are known as pinpoint areas, or areas where, according to the data, the gun violence is the worst. And they would say, okay, well, what resources can we put in this area? And so this tactical committee was made up of people from, the mental health service providers, conflict resolution providers, job training providers, addiction counseling providers, for example, on the community crisis intervention program folks, or the people who represent that organization. So where are we putting folks who have credibility in the streets and know the people who are beefing, and they can intervene and stop these conflicts and quash the beefs before guns are pulled? And they track all of that, and so they look at where those, there's literally, these are digital maps, and they can track where all that goes, and then look at the trends and see where they're making improvements or where the violence is being reduced. At one point, there was a task force, a law enforcement task force, on the 5th Street and 7th Street gangs in South Philly. And what they did was we tracked this in this committee, and we were able to find that there was a reduction of shootings there, I want to say, for about a month. Now, this was largely, I think this was actually largely before the pandemic, which made a lot of things worse, obviously. But we saw signs of improvement. Like, I mean, I'm just telling you what we saw, what police were reporting in these meetings. We had a long way to go, but we saw glimmers that this strategy was working. And there were efforts to try to beef it up and put more resources into it. But that's one way of using data to deal with it. When they say they're data driven, that's what they mean. They're looking at not just police data, but they're looking at, and one of the things we're trying to do is have every department use a scorecard and measure what success is to them. And, you know, another thing we would do is we had something called the out of the Office of Violence Prevention, the Targeted Community Investment Grants, which were grants that go, I think now they're going up to about $20,000. And these were grants, micro grants, that would support these smaller community-driven groups. Like, say somebody decides to create a class where you learn how to make music or do video or do creative writing, anything that could get would give young people at risk of violence life skills, coping mechanisms, mental health, counseling, things like that, and with the hope that it can give people who may be involved in that life, or they may be considering getting involved in that life, giving them another option, something that would help them find life fulfillment and get them away from a life of crime. You know, and also job training services, things like that, career building, skill building, you know, so that they become more marketable and they're able to provide for themselves in a way, that doesn't involve criminal, violent gang activity. And so they would look at these maps and they'd say, okay, well, if, you know, we're putting all these resources here, and think of it as like a color coding thing on a map. And so we got all these resources in this area and we're seeing, are we seeing a reduction in violence? No. Okay. Well, let's add a little bit more. Let's, you know, what more can we add here? You know, and what are, and it helps you identify the needs of the community too. So for example, if there's an area that, that has a lot of darkness, you know, on the street, you know, where people can hide their criminal activity in the dark, the streets department would go in. They had a little bit of funding under this plan, and they would go in and they'd provide some lighting in that area. So you were able to mobilize specific agencies to go in and provide specific needs based on what the crime trends are in these pinpoint areas and what the data is showing us. Another example is, okay, you know, do you need a clean and seal is what they would call it. So you have an abandoned home where people would hide their drugs or they'd hide their money or they'd, or illicit activity would take place there, sometimes even prostitution, things like that. Well, if we can go in and clean those abandoned homes and seal them up so no one can get in there, okay, well, now that criminal activity has to go somewhere else. It was that type of thing. And we found that those types of things did make a difference, you know, in some respect. And listen, I'm not speaking for the government now. I'm just telling you what the data told us then. You know, I'm not a government spokesperson now. So, I mean, I'm just trying to give you an analysis. I'm not, you know, I'm not taking anybody's side in this. I just want everyone to be clear, you know. I just think it's an interesting perspective to share. So these were all of the tactics that went under the roadmap to Safer Communities. Using data to better understand the problem. I'm going to position this microphone in a different way. I'm using a different microphone here, it's a little bit of an experimental setup, so bear with me as we make our way through this here. And a lot of it also had to do with updating the community. So we would do these regular updates, community updates every quarter on what every office was doing, you know, how many properties were cleaned and sealed in terms of, you know, how many abandoned properties, you know, where we put lighting in dark areas, where we strengthened town watch services, where, like say groups, neighborhood groups got together, they created a town watch, who was leading it, how we could plug that person into some of the other social services that are offered so that they can get those resources out there. Where can the community crisis intervention program go, not just to try to quash these beefs and have a, you know, reach the people who are involved in the violence, but, you know, hand out resources so that people can get out of that life. Another thing we did was the creation of a strategy called group violence intervention. And this is based on, you know, John Jay College had a large, large part in this. David Kennedy I would say the word would be forefather, you know, or maybe grandfather of this strategy. And he's based out of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. And this strategy was largely based on what Boston did, which was a ceasefire approach that brought where law enforcement, the courts, you know, probation and community groups and behavioral health folks, all of these you know, people got together. They did what was called the term is generally a call-in. It's a meeting where all of these folks involved in group violence, you know, groups known to be violent, you get them together in a room and they say, if you get out of this life, we're going to help you. There's resources for you to get out of this life, but the shooting has to stop. It has to come to a full stop. If it doesn't, then you will face certain and swift legal consequences. That's basically the language that we used in the city of Philadelphia when we launched the program. But it's based on that model. It's this idea that you give people, you through law enforcement, every available and appropriate law enforcement mechanism, you identify the people. You know, the data shows that most of the violence is driven by small active groups. That's what the data generally says. And so if you can engage these people, let them know, we know who you are, we know what you're doing, We want you to know what your legal vulnerabilities are. If you keep this up, we will prosecute you. And in some ways, what they would do is, you know, the various applications of this strategy around the country is they would look and they could cut power to houses. You know, they could find way, you know, if they have fines or something, they can enforce the various fines that they might have. They could really try to, I don't want to say bring the house down, but every agency that touched their life in some way would engage a penalty if they did not stop in their involvement in group violence and shootings and that sort of thing. So we did that in the city of Philadelphia. We launched it. There was a previous version called Focus Deterrence. The criticism that many had for that program is that it wasn't heavy on the social services. In other words, it was too much law enforcement coming in and saying, we know who you are, we're going to bust you if you keep shooting and killing people. There wasn't enough there to entice them to get out of that life. In other words, the group violence intervention model, which was some might say reboot, it was a different program. It operated differently, but it was a second coming of focused deterrence, other people might say, is that it had more of those social services. It had the behavioral health folks. It had the counseling. It had the addiction specialists. It had the, you know, if you needed to get out of a dangerous situation, if you know, these are not only people who have a high risk of shooting and killing someone, these are people who have a high risk of being shot and killed. So if you can get them out of a dangerous situation, there's money in the pot to find temporary housing or get them away from that and save their life and hopefully prevent them from, you know, preventing retaliation and, you know, saving life there. You stop one shooting, you can stop many others potentially with that theory. And so that's the strategy on the ground now. We launched it in August 1st of 2020. So it's almost a year and a half old now, not quite. And that strategy was credited for major reductions in shootings in Southwest Philadelphia. Even when I went back into news reporting, I covered a community meeting out there a few months ago, and the police captain said it really did make a difference there. Because again, the data does show that it's a large number. I mean, it's a small number of people in active groups committing this violence. So if you can engage these people and get them out of that life, you're saving their life. You're saving the community more trauma. And you're investing in people too by getting them these resources to, you know, learn a skill. Maybe they want to get into packaging. Maybe they want to get into construction. One of the things our office was doing was working with the building trades and trying to get them, some of these folks who have had a checkered past, you know, not necessarily maybe a homicide, but, you know, some other things that they've done. And get them a job, have them earn some money, be able to take care of their families, do it in an honorable way that doesn't involve violence or anything like that. So these are the strategies that are in place now. At last check, I mean, when I left the city, I know that there was an interest in expanding the group violence intervention model. I do know that they've done an expansion in grant funding, because the idea is which was backed by data that we saw coming in too, if you invest, you know, the people closest to the problems are the people closest to the solutions, okay? And this feeling that, you know, we don't, in this, the ivory towers of City Hall, there's not enough investment back into the community. So if you can take grant money and put it into these organizations, especially some of these larger ones that have shown that if they can give young people a safe place to go, they're, especially during after school hours, they're less likely to engage in violence. One group is the NOMO Foundation, for example, which we've done a lot with both in media and in terms of government supporting groups like that. There's a new grant. Well, in the last budget, they passed about $155 million. I worked on the language and kind of putting all this out in the city, too. I lined up interviews for the press and wrote some of the language for how we were discussing this new investment, $155 million in violence prevention related funding. And part of that was about $22 million to go into some of these larger groups where it could be anywhere from, and I'm looking at the breakdown now because, in fact, let me pull this up. I want to make sure that I get this to you the right way here, the community expansion grant. Right before I ended up leaving city government, we got word that the council president had some money that they were going to move over for violence prevention. So, the anti-violence community expansion grant directly funds and supports organizations that are focused on reducing violence through the trauma-informed healing and restorative practices and safe havens and mentorship. The city will provide grants between $100,000 and $1 million to community-based organizations that have an annual operating annual operating budgets below $15 million and a proven track record working in neighborhoods vulnerable to gun violence. Basically, what they were looking to do, as we talked about this plan in the early days, right before I left the city, was looking at the mid-sized programs. So not just the smaller ones that work maybe, you know, with a few dozen people here and there, but some of the larger organizations, like a large community center, after-school program, that type of thing. And that's where the city is now. Another thing they're doing is the federal government, through a national violence prevention partnership with the federal level, the Biden administration, is they're working with select cities like Philadelphia to help police with anything from technical assistance and staffing, ways to better crack down on some of these cases and solve them. So there's a lot of that going on too. But, I do think there's a lot of things that the community doesn't know about. I think we did, I saw a difference myself in more people learning about this stuff. You know, when I was with the city, I certainly saw a major difference in people discovering what the city's doing. Before I took this communications job, I was kind of amazed how many people did not know what was being done, you know. And so I'm glad that, over that time, I saw a major improvement in that. But I think there's always, there's always more work to do with anything. Some of the work also involved just writing about this in terms of writing testimony for city officials to speak, to write a lot of the language that our senior officials would deliver before city council, specifically the council special committee on gun violence prevention, so that we had a chance to update the legislative branch on what we were doing. And then speeches for the mayor and other officials as they went public and talked about what we're doing. So, I can tell you this. I mean, I know everybody that I've worked with takes this extremely personally. They move with a very deep emotional connection to what's happening, and they're in this community too. So I certainly know the toll it's taken on people I worked with. And it's the same thing in the press. I mean, I've seen the toll it takes on people, my colleagues in the press. And I think I felt that the other day with, I know I felt that the other day with the murder of Jessica Covington, the woman 7 months pregnant who just got home from her own baby shower. So there's no question more needs to be done. There's a debate over, and this is more involving the district attorney's office, there's been a debate over how these types of things are handled when it comes to criminal justice reform, when it comes to, whether or not the charges are appropriate for people who are repeat offenders. I think there's going to be an intensification of that. I think that's an objective, fair statement to make, and we'll certainly cover it all. But I saw, the last thing I'll say is I think that was one of the interesting points that I observed was what is this balance between law enforcing the law, maintaining the basics of the criminal justice system while putting reform up as a priority too, and trying to see where these, remember, I'm the communications guy. I'm not the person writing the policy, but I work with the people who are writing the policy and carrying out the policy and trying to see how they were balancing it from, I think, several different perspectives, a personal perspective. There was a political perspective there. Certainly Philadelphia is a predominantly a liberal city. And so in cities like Philadelphia, which I think are most major cities in the country, if you just look at the voting records and their policies, there's a more modern progressive approach towards criminal justice reform. What does that mean? How is that applied and balanced is what many senior officials would ask themselves. So yeah, it was an interesting thing to watch and learn and see. While again, everyone agreed we have to do everything we can. You know, the problem too is that with COVID-19, the city lost about a 700. There was a 750 or so million-dollar budget hole that had to be reduced. So there were cuts to various services. There was one office that provided job training and support that had to be shut down because businesses were shut down. You couldn't, there was a stay-at-home order, right? So that hurt things. And the city worked since the height of COVID-19 to bring a lot of those services back online. There's still a ways to go, I think, in terms of restoring some of that from what I've seen. But I saw some of that happening too. How are we bringing these agencies that we had to shut down back online? I remember a meeting back in March where at the height of COVID-19, the courts were shut down, probation was shut down. And so cases weren't going before judges because, and plus there was the reduction of the jail population in part to control the releasing lower level offenders and dealing with, as we tried to prevent a large spread of COVID-19 in the jails. So there were a lot of things that happened. And then as the government started coming back online, it took forever for a lot of the courts to come back online. It took forever. I'm not sure where, I got to check where everything is with probation now, but it took a long time for probation to come back online. So that was an impact in all of this. So the impact of the pandemic was, we could write a book about that. I mean, the experts in this field, sociologists, the academics are going to look at this for a long, long time, the impact of everything. So I just wanted to give a very brief, this is probably, an hour, a very introductory approach to how the city tries to handle this. And as far as where they go in the future, I know they want to do more community investment. I know they want to spend more money into the community. There's also people asking, well, are these programs working, all of this spending? That was one of the criticisms that we faced at the Office of Violence Prevention in August of 2020. I think at that point we might have, were we at 300 homicides? We were climbing, certainly moving in the wrong direction. And, there was a concern that there was a lack of data. And I can certainly tell you that there was an internal frustration that it took a while to get the evaluation piece done, because in many ways they're still trying to move pieces, get them in a precise order for these programs to make sure they're running at their maximum efficiency. And there are still questions about evaluation that many people in the community are asking. How do we know these programs are working? So I suspect that that's forthcoming. In fact, a newsletter that I used to work on, I got the other day, and actually this week, last week, and it said that they're looking for a person to handle to work with an organization and I'm saying this in a very simplistic fashion, but to handle the evaluation of it. So they're still working on that. So there's going to be more questions about evaluation, I think. There's going to be more questions about where the money's going, how equitable of a fashion this is, There's a lot of community groups that I've heard from back on the reporting side that they've said, you know, we have programs and we've been turned down for grant money. The money seems to be going to the same people all the time with, and, you know, many of these, some of these community groups say, you know, and do we know whether these groups are effective or not? So there's a lot of pieces that are still at work in all of this. As the community continues to talk about it, as city officials continue to talk about it, and certainly as journalists continue to cover it. So wanted to give a little bit of an idea of what's happening on the ground. But I also hope that we continue to think about the people who we've lost. I mean, 500 people. It's an unprecedented, tragic record in this city. It was already a 30-year high last year. And the reporting I'm seeing and the data I'm seeing says that we've never had a number quite like this, and especially since we're not even done with November. So my prayers go out to the victims, and certainly I'm thinking about all the people who are in the community every day trying to get this thing under control, and all the people out there telling these stories too. So you know, as we move into the Thanksgiving Day, which is actually tomorrow as of the taping of this show, you know, let's be safe, let's love each other, have good times, but also think about those we've lost, and not just with the violence, but COVID and so many other things that we're battling at one time today. So cheers and good health to you all. Thank you for just checking this out and letting me ramble a little bit. But hopefully we learned something together, and we will keep on this. Thank you all, and take care.